Honorable Judges of the United States Court of Appeals in and for the Seventh Circuit, hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
First case for argument this morning is State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company versus the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue, Mr. Perlmutter.
May it please the court, my name is Edward Perlmutter and I represent the Commissioner in this case. This is a complex case involving an unusual entity where the tax court reached a demonstrably wrong result in our opinion. The tax court read the book income adjustment regulation at issue in a manner that nullifies the relevant statutory provision for State Farm's 1989 taxable year, treats the $621 million loss in State Farm's non-life subgroup for that year as a nullity for book income adjustment purposes, and creates the absurd result that the non-life subgroup's preliminary pre-adjustment $621 million loss.
How? Forgive me, Mr. Perlmutter.
Yes.
How do we get past the plain language of 56.1A3?
The regulation has no plain meaning in this unusual context, Your Honor. As we showed in our brief, to read the regulation in the manner the State Farm suggests renders it internally contradictory. It also has the effect of nullifying the relevant statutory provisions during this year. And as the Supreme Court, emphasized in the Shell Oil case, which is cited in both our opening brief and our reply brief, courts must be careful not to read statutory regulatory language in a manner that nullifies statutory provisions.
Now, the drafters of the AMT book income adjustments regulations were alerted to the fact that 56.1A3 didn't specifically account for a consolidated group made up of non-life and life subgroups, but they didn't alter the regulation. How do we get past that? As you can see, I've had to learn a new language here.
This is a very readily understandable decision on the Treasury's part, and if you place everything in proper context, you'll see that it doesn't support State Farm's position, and in fact can be used in a manner that undermines State Farm's position in this case. You have to remember that we're dealing with a statute here that was in effect only for 3 years, 1987, 1988, 1989. So the book income adjustment regulation necessarily was in effect only for those 3 years. Consider also that we're dealing here with a very unusual entity, which probably comprises less than 1% of all consolidated groups.
Let me be very open with you. Your policy arguments might be very convincing if we weren't dealing with what looks to be an oversight in the regulations, and that is my problem.
Well, I hope I can alleviate your problem, that there is no oversight. What you have to understand is that this regulation is written for the 99% of consolidated groups that are not non-life groups. 99% of consolidated groups are single entities. That's why you need a single book income adjustment in that situation. But as this court has stressed in the First National Bank of Chicago case, the use of singular or plural language is not dispositive. Everything depends on context. When you place this regulation in its proper context and understand what the purpose of this particular adjustment is for a life, non-life group, there is only one rational result in this case. It's the subgroup approach. The subgroup approach provides the right result in this case, and it will provide the right result in every case. Now, I'd like to point out to you that if you read the reading of this as a single, providing for a single book income adjustment necessarily creates an irreconcilable conflict within the regulation. And the critical provision here is 56B3(3), which defines consolidated pre-adjustment taxable income. Now, in that part of the regulation, the it's called the taxable income of the group. The group in that case is the subgroup. It has to be the subgroup for various reasons. Taxable income is a negative figure in that part of the regulation. It's a negative figure in the statute. In the unique context of life, non-life groups, negative figures exist only at the subgroup level. They don't exist at the consolidated life, non-life level, the entity level as a whole. The only way you can reconcile that language with the language of the relevant statutory provisions is to read it as allowing for negative figures. And the only way you can allow for negative figures is to read it as applying to the subgroup. It can't apply to the group as a whole. The group as a whole cannot compute a negative figure. That's one point. There are several other reasons why the subgroup is the group for that purposes of the of that portion of the regulation. This is, as we showed in our brief, this is just one step in the process by which each subgroup computes its final income or loss figure during the year. We're not at the stage of the process where the group as a whole is computing a final taxable income figure. The structure, as we understand it, is set forth at page 30 of our opening brief. If you accept that structure, the result here is foreordained. There's no way you can exclude a subgroup's own pre-adjustment income from the computation of its post-adjustment income, but that's precisely what has happened in this case. I'd like to point out to you that State Farm itself treated the subgroup as the group in B3(3) of the regulation. It did so at page 36 of the separate appendix at Mr. Lovell's affidavit. That affidavit shows two specific discrete subgroup pre-adjustment AMTI figures at 2C. It shows a negative 621 figure in the non-life subgroup, and it shows a 262 figure in the life subgroup. So they themselves made a computation that is at odds with their own plain meaning argument. The bottom line here is that there is no plain meaning in this regulation. The regulation is not written for this context, and it has to be construed in light of the unique structure of a life, non-life group. What we're dealing with here is an entity that consists of two distinct consolidated groups, a life subgroup and a non-life subgroup. They are independent taxable entities, and they proceed generally on independent grounds until the end of the process when they combine. And this here, we are just at one stage of the process when they are in the when they are computing their own taxable income or loss. We're not at the end of the process. We're at in the middle of the day. We're not at the end of the day. If you read the regulation in light of the unique structure of a life, non-life subgroup, there's only one rational result. It's our result. That conforms the results to the relevant statutory provisions. Now, to get back to your question about the Treasury's decision to not amend, consider the circumstances. We're dealing with a statute that is only in effect for a very limited period of time. We're dealing with an issue that affects a very limited category of taxpayers. If the Treasury would have wanted to go ahead and amend the regulation, it would have to have gone to and issued proposed regulations, go through a whole notice and comment proceeding, delay implementation of the final regulations, and therefore delay the proper instruction to the 99% of others. Entities that aren't covered by this particular issue.
Well, Ms. Brillmer, didn't we? The Commissioner seems to acknowledge some tension between the statute and the regulations.
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
You don't
not. In fact, we allege that there is an irreconcilable tension between their reading of the regulation and the relevant statute. The relevant statute is Section 56D2A. Section 56D2A says alternative minimum tax net operating losses must be reduced by the various adjustments in that statute. Those adjustments include the book income adjustment. Now here, there has been a $621 million net operating loss for AMT purposes computed in the non-life subgroup for 1989, but there has been no book income adjustment for 1989. And there should have been, because under any rational approach, the book income for 1989 exceeded the net operating loss. The only way that they've gotten this, created this distortion, is by taking that $621 million figure and taking it out of the whole computation and converting it to zero.
Well, of course, that happened because it was computed separately as a carryback from 1989, right?
No, we're in the process of computing the carryback.
Right.
We're in the process of computing how much of a carryback there is.
Look, what I'm trying to say is that the $621 million loss didn't affect State Farm's 1987 book income adjustment calculation because it was computed separately as a carryback from 1989.
Well, the problem is, the issue is, it relates to its 1989 book income adjustment calculation.
You know, I see your white light is on. I don't want to take your time, but I want to ask you something, and it's this. Didn't the commissioner waive its second two proposed computation methods by failing to raise them in the tax court?
Well, as an honest matter, Your Honor, we think that the first computation, alternatively, is the correct computation.
So the answer is yes.
Yes, we're not really concerned about those alternatives. But I want to point out to you that if you they are taking inconsistent positions here with respect to the second argument. The only way they've gotten this $621 million figure out is by taking inconsistent positions. On the one hand, they're telling the court, don't compute this, don't interpret this regulation in conformity with 1503C. And then when the commissioner came back and said, okay, we'll use the explicit terms of example fuller of the regulation and compute it that way, they said, no, we can't do that. We have to use 1503. That's barred by 1503C. They can't have it both ways. Either you read the regulation in conformity with 1503C, which is our subgroup approach, or you read it as a self-contained entity without regard to 1503C, which means you apply the literal language of Example 4 of the regulation. You're going to get a similar computation. The only way that you get a distortion and create a zero book income adjustment for 1989 is by reading the regulation on the one hand as treating them as the usual single entity, and on the other hand, treating them as an unusual non-life group. They can't have it both ways. They shouldn't be able to pick and choose which aspect of 1503 and the regulation they like and which aspect they don't like.
One second, Mr. Perlmutter. The commissioner had 20 minutes? And when did the light go on? You reserved 5, didn't you?
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so we've gone 15 minutes into the commissioner's time?
Okay.
We'll have to check our courtroom clock. Thank you, Mr. Perlmutter.
Something.
Mr. Lemon?
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Several comments on some of the questions that were asked, and also Mr. Perlmutter's observations that we have been taking an inconsistent position. We don't think that's correct, obviously. We believe we have followed the language of the regulations and the statute in computing the book income adjustment on a consolidated basis, as the statute tells us to do and as the regulations tell us to do. Now, it is an unusual situation where you have life and non-life subgroups, but the language of the regulations is to compute this adjustment on the basis of the taxable income of the consolidated group. It does not say subgroup, it says group. And as just Rovner pointed out, the problem of subgroups was called to the attention of the regulations drafters, and they did not make any change in the temporary regulations. And
it was 1990 period?
Yes, it was 19. Well, it was probably during the 89-90 period when they were trying to finalize temporary regulations. They made other changes. It would not have delayed anything to have added this as a change had they wished to do so. This is a pure policy question, as Judge Rovner indicated. They could have gone either way. They chose to stay with the group concept. Now, why did they do that? I think there's an obvious explanation for that. And that is in the example four, the famous example four that everybody refers to, where you have more or less the paradigm case. Two subgroups, we'll call them, although example four talks only about corporations, but assume they were subgroups. And one had more book income than taxable income, and the other had more taxable income than book income. What example four tells us is that you aggregate the taxable income of all the members, and then you test it against the aggregate book income of all the members. But you do aggregate. And if you did not aggregate, if you had a pure subgroup approach, so you drew a line down the middle, and you said one group will be calculated one way, one subgroup one way, one subgroup the other way, the subgroup where the taxable income was greater than the book income would not have any benefit reflected in the overall adjustment, because you only deal with the book income adjustment if it exceeds the taxable income.
Of course, and we're never going to see this problem again, are we?
This statute was repealed at the end of 1989, correct, Your Honor. And so from the standpoint of the technical issue here involved on these facts and these words and the book income adjustment we're dealing with, you are correct. And here we are, 2004, still trying to figure out what it means for the years 87, 88, and 89. Now, in 1987, the State Farm group had exactly the paradigm case that I described. One subgroup had more book income than taxable income. The other subgroup had more taxable income than book income. And the numbers were aggregated, and it was determined that a book income adjustment was called for in that year, but only after aggregating. In its answer in the tax court, the commissioner decided it didn't like aggregation. So it amended and said, no, we shouldn't do it that way. Well, that position, which is their position here in court today, nullifies example four. So if we want to talk about nullification, what they are trying to do is cause this court to read the word group to mean subgroup. And if you do that, you nullify example four. And the whole thrust of the aggregation concept reflected in example four. And that's the paradigm case. We have a case where we incurred a loss in one subgroup, and Congress, for reasons of policy relating to the decision to allow life and non-life companies to consolidate, which was a new development in the early 1980s, said we will not allow unlimited use of losses by one subgroup against the other's income. We will put limits on that. That's the only context in the Internal Revenue Code where there are limits on use of losses of this type in this way.
And why should that be?
Well, that was another policy decision made by the Congress at the time. It allowed consolidation. It was concerned that if a non-life operation incurred a major loss, as can happen from time to time, that it would use that entire loss to offset the income of the life side of the group. And Congress felt life insurance companies, even in a consolidated environment, should pay some tax every year, because the bulk of their income is generally earned from investments. And Congress felt that losses from extraordinary casualty results like hurricanes and so on should not totally offset the income of the life side of the group in a specific year. So they put limits on the use in each year. You could only offset up to 35% of the loss or 35% of the life company's income.
In that regard, either like or unlike my colleagues, it's a challenging case for me. Assuming that the non-life losses are carried back, and mainly applied to non-life gains, is there any allocation for the 87 non-life subgroup?
Well, if there is a book income adjustment in that year, and if there was, you would allocate that adjustment between the two subgroups in order to ensure proper application of that carryback. That's the point the tax court addressed at the very end of its opinion. It recognizes this is not a perfect set of rules.
Well, there's no allocation in this case, though.
No, there was. It was not an issue in the case. There was no allocation because it was not an issue. It didn't affect the outcome one way or the other, because an allocation would only increase the capacity to absorb the loss, and there was sufficient capacity without the allocation. But the tax court studied this, the tax court analyzed it, the tax court, in our opinion, got it right. They understood that this is not a perfect set of regulations, but when you look at how they were drafted and you look at the fact that the issue was called to the attention of the drafters, and they did not make a change, it's not as though they failed to think about it, then you must take the words as written, and it's not for a court to come along and write a whole new set of regulations that would accommodate what the commissioner would like to see in this case, which is the unusual case, the paradigm case, as I indicated, is example four. If you adopt the commissioner's approach here, you would be nullifying the approach taken in example four of allowing aggregation of taxable income of both subgroups and book income of both subgroups.
Would you agree that the commissioner's approach captures the regular tax system's preference for non-life and life subgroups filing consolidated returns to arrive at a at their taxable income figures independently, and then after applying Section 1503's loss limitation rules, compute a consolidated figure for regular tax purposes?
Had the drafters chosen to proceed in that fashion, it probably would be a situation where you would not be able to challenge that approach as being invalid. But they chose to go a different route. And they chose to apply the book income adjustment on a consolidated basis, presumably to ensure the policy of allowing aggregation of book income and taxable income for the whole group. And therefore, the commissioner is left with the words of the regulations that he doesn't like in this case. As we point out in our brief, another set of facts with a different set of numbers, even with a loss involved, the commissioner would come out ahead for the year in issue.
In that vein, if this same formula were applied in different years, you say that it would benefit perhaps the government as opposed to the company. You know, if this just happens because of Hurricane Hugo?
Yes.
Because of the huge loss that, and it was aggregated, that this is the benefit to the company in this consolidated arrangement.
Yes, sir.
The commissioner refers to this being 99%. This is maybe a 1% issue, but there must be other life, non-life companies that apply the same formula, aren't there?
They would all apply the same formula, but it would appear after a 15-year history that this issue has come to the surface only once.
Well, that's my curiosity. Everybody had to file a tax return. I assume others were similarly wounded by Hurricane Hugo, et cetera. I just wondered, apparently in your research, you have not found any other precedent about how those companies filed their returns and whether they followed this formula.
But there's nothing in the record to indicate that one way or the other, Judge Mannion, but we have to assume they all followed the same approach. It may be their mix of numbers was such that they were able to come out with a result that the commissioner found acceptable.
Maybe they just didn't have actuaries as smart as yours.
It could be. It certainly could be. We don't know the answer to that. You're right, Judge Rice. But I think the ultimate point to be made here is that the words are written, the issue is addressed, the words have to be applied as they're written. They are very clear in saying you start with the taxable income of the entire consolidated group. Congress mandated that in 1989, in our case, one of those numbers would be a zero because the subgroup, the non-life subgroup, had a loss, and they must, for consolidated purposes, not show a loss, they show a zero, and you just go from there.
Am I correct in thinking that the $621 million loss didn't affect State Farm's 1987 book income adjustment calculation because it was computed separately as a carryback?
It is the
from
last
1989.
You are correct, Judge Roman. That's what the regulations require. You take the carryback into account as the very last step in the process after the book income adjustment is calculated. That's correct. Now, as the commissioner says, we ignore the rule of Section 56D2A, which says net operating losses should be adjusted by various amounts, including any book income adjustment. And we do not ignore that. It just happened in this case there was none to be made in 1989 because of the way the results came out once you put the zero on the taxable income line of the non-life subgroup. Had the numbers been slightly different, had the non-life group had positive book income, it turned out to have a negative $40 million of book income. Had it had a positive $40 million of book income, there would have been a book income adjustment in this year. It would have been a small amount, but there would have been one. And some portion of that would have been allocated to the carryback amount before it was carried back. So there is no attempt, no result that ignores Section 56D2A in this case. It just happens to be the way the numbers come out on these facts. And we believe the tax court got it right. We believe they were the tax court understood the issue and analyzed it correctly.
And of course, your view is that the commissioner's approach would contravene the loss limitation rules of 1503C.
Well, the commissioner would postpone application of those to the moment of his choosing rather than to let them be applied at the point in time when the regulations and the statute require it, namely in computing the taxable income of the consolidated group, which means what number did the group put on the tax return it filed for 1989? And we know that number. We know that number was a positive $261 million, all attributable to the life group, because the non-life number on the tax return, according to Congress's mandate, had to be zero. It could not be a negative number. That's just the way the rules are, but they are the congressional rules. And you start with that number, and then you determine whether there's a book income adjustment to be made. And because you start with a zero and a $262 million mix, you do not make a book income adjustment for the year 1989 as the rules are applied. If there are no other questions, thank you very much.
Let me try to clear up some confusion for you, Judge Rovner, if I can.
Thank you.
If you have our separate appendix at page 36, it'd be worthwhile to look at this exactly, to see what they've pulled here. Okay. You see, for the 1989 taxable year, which is the critical taxable year here, you see a non-life subgroup and you see a life subgroup, right? You see two.
I'm looking at your table one. Is that
table? One? That's right. You see two distinct subgroups there.
Bless you.
Okay. You see, State Farm using those that subgroup approach up until line 2C. You see that? You see a $621 million subgroup pre-adjustment AMTI before carryback there. And you see a $262 million positive income in the life subgroup.
Right.
Turn to the next page. Where do you see that non-life subgroup pre-adjustment carryback?
Quick, tell me.
Nowhere. There is no line 2D on that. It's hocus pocus. They've made it disappear from their 1989 taxable year. You see? They haven't taken it into account. They've converted that 621 into zero at line 2E. It's not zero. If there was no zero, if it was zero, they wouldn't have any file left carried back to go back to 1987. It has to be taken, that pre-adjustment loss has to be taken into account. That's the essence of this case. It's a case where minus 621 is not zero.
But they did it by carrying back the $621 million loss before calculating their AMT consolidated work income adjustment.
But the point is that they took out the pre-adjustment loss from the computation of the final post-adjustment loss. That's what they've done. You can't get a post-adjustment loss if you don't have a pre-adjustment loss. The book income adjustment can only reduce your pre-adjustment loss to a post-adjustment loss. What the tax court said is that it didn't affect a fully satisfactory harmonization of the schemes. The tax court itself recognized the problem in its decision at page 25 of the mandatory appendix. That's because the only satisfactory reconciliation is the subgroup approach. They followed the subgroup approach all the way up to the point, the critical point here. It's only here where they departed from it. And they departed from it in order to get that pre-adjustment income that pre-adjustment loss out of the computation. If they had kept it in there, which they should have, they might have computed a huge book income adjustment for 1989. That's the essence of this case. This case is about the book income adjustment computation for 1989. They've completely distorted the process. They've created an impression that does not comport with reality. Their book income from 1989 exceeds their taxable income, their loss, under any rational measure. It's only by taking that $621 million figure out and not putting it back in and converting it to zero that they arrive at the ridiculous result they've arrived here.
Mr. Miller, apart from the structural analysis that you want to lay on this case, is there, can the commissioner point to anything in the code or the regs that actually refers to the subgroup as a consolidated group?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Section 1502.47H2(2) of the Consolidated Return Regulations, which is cited at page 21 of our opening brief and page 13 of our reply brief, explicitly defines the non-life subgroup that computes a loss as the group, the counterpart of the ordinary consolidated group that computes a net operating loss consolidated under the regular provision. I can read that provision that's from page 13 of our reply brief.
13?
Yeah. It's at the third line, right at the end of, you see that?
I have it.
It is the group. It's a consolidated group. I see my time is up, so we just request that either the court enter judgment on one of the two arguments that we made in this case. And
Well, going to give you a fair reply. Unheard of.
Thank you, Mr. Perlman.
Thank you very much.
If I turn, where was I turning?
The fair reply consists of responding as willing to Judge Rovner's inquiry. I mean, there's no time frame on this.
Thank you.
So if I turn to page 37, why isn't 2C, the subgroup pre-adjustment, noted anywhere?
If you look at 36 and 37 together, which you must in this case, the only difference between them is in 36 for 89, we had a loss which we showed temporarily as a negative figure. We then, in line 2D, followed
the
construction
mandate,
carried it back and showed a zero. The line 2E is the counterpart of line 2C on the other. Subgroups are not taxable groups. They do not file tax returns. Only the entire group files a tax return, so we must follow the congressional mandate. Thank you.
Perlmutter, thank you. Whitten, thank you. And your co-counsel, we thank. The case is taken under advisement.